Hello. So my talk is called Tara and the Tears of Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara weeps a lake of tears for the suffering of sentient beings, and from the lake of tears Tara emerges. So as Varabhadra just said, it's been 17 years since I was last at Taraloka. That was my first GFR retreat, and that was not long after I came here on a disastrous working retreat, which you were on. I turned up here with a terrible hangover, actually quite drunk still. I just sort of stumbled onto a bus going vaguely in the right direction and wound up sort of stranded somewhere like Nantwich or somewhere. Had to phone Akashati. She had to phone Taraloka, they got me a taxi. And then I lasted 2 days before someone had to drive me back to the station because I just couldn't take any more positivity. So I'm in a much better place this time round. But in terms of our planet, the Earth, things have changed for the worst. So I don't think anything's prepared us for the rate at which things have changed. In the last 50 years particularly, things have changed dramatically. The M1 motorway wasn't even finished till the 70s. And things like mobile phones and the internet were like stuff off Star Trek. I saw this thing on the internet the other day. It was a question. If someone from the 50s appeared today, what would be the most difficult thing to explain to them about life today? And so someone's answered, I possess a device in my pocket that is capable of accessing the entirety of information known to man. I use it to look at pictures of cats and get into arguments with strangers. So since we effectively worked out how to extract oil in large quantities, so over the last 200 years or so, we've seen dramatic changes in human life on Earth. Oil not only increases the rate at which we can extract all the other so-called raw materials, but it allows us to do agriculture on this sort of enormous scale. So we use oil for fertilisers, to make pesticides, which eventually sort of denude the soil. We use it to irrigate crops, we use it to transport them, freeze them, store them, and obviously to wrap them in plastic. So before 1800, there was about 1 billion people on the Earth. And the second billion was reached in 1930. But the third billion was reached in 1960. And since then, we've continued to increase to the point where there's 6 billion or more of us on the Earth at the moment, and that's set to be 9 or 10 billion by the middle of this century. So we've had huge medical breakthroughs and social change breakthroughs in the West, but the single biggest factor that's allowed us to increase our numbers to this extent has been being able to extract oil at the rate that we can today. So I remember when I was a child, a carrot was something that either came out of the garden or it came in a paper bag. It was covered in earth. They were all kinds of shapes. There was some with three legs, some with sort of like two legs and a willy. Sort of hours of entertainment in those long dark evenings before we had the internet. So today, unless you still grow your own or you support local farmers by getting a veg box, carrots come in plastic, they've been transported, they're pretty much all the same size, they're all clean, we don't even have to get our hands dirty. My rabbit just died recently, a few weeks ago. She was a house rabbit, she was 10 and I really loved her. But even my rabbit could tell the difference between an organic carrot and an inorganic carrot. So I normally have organic. And if you offered her an inorganic carrot, she'd take a few seconds to work out what it was before she took it. Whereas if you give her an organic carrot, she'd just grab it and run under the settee with it, you know. So all this farming has been done on the land. So we've had to clear the land to make way for our crops, and we've cleared the land to make way for so-called progress. And with the loss of the land comes the loss of the habitats of other species. So I have a quote here from the Centre for Biological Diversity. It's frightening but true. Our planet is now in the midst of the sixth mass extinction of plants and animals. So if Centre for Biological Diversity sounds a bit obscure, even the World Wildlife Fund is now talking about the sixth mass extinction. So the quote continues. Unlike past mass extinctions caused by events like asteroid strikes, volcanic eruptions, and natural climate shifts, the current crisis is almost entirely caused by us. Because the rate of change in our biosphere is increasing, and because every species extinction leads to the extinction of others, bound to that species, in a complex ecological web, numbers of extinctions are likely to snowball in the coming decades as ecosystems unravel. So I'd like to talk a little bit about Green Tara. Avalokiteshvara weeps a lake of tears, and from the lake of tears, Tara arises. So Green Tara is shown seated with her left leg in meditation posture, but with her right leg, she steps down into the world to go to the aid of living beings. So not long after I was ordained, I went to visit Banti along with my good friend Apeksha Devi. And I brought my Tara Rupa for Banti to bless. So Banti sits there sort of holding Tara, and he looks down at her and he sort of says, "Oh yes." And then he blesses Tara, and then he goes away and he comes back with this sort of white offering scarf thing, like a sort of Tibetan thing, and he sort of wraps Tara in it and gives her to me. And so I said to Banti, "Banti, you did the Green Tara practice. Do you have any tips?" And Banti said, "Do it every day." But then he said, "Well, you could think about nature, because nature is green." So nature has always been my inspiration, the beauty of nature. So I grew up in a small town, which was quite depressing from a certain point of view. But for a small child, it was a kind of paradise, because there were woods to explore and a river where you could swim and wild places, sort of endless, quiet, green places where you'd hardly ever see another human being. So I always felt very close to nature. I wanted to be a witch. I used to make these sort of potions out of like little fallen apples and rose petals and lavender, and I'd leave them out under the full moon to brew, you know. It was a place, and a place in time, where you could be a wild girl. And when I was about 9, I wanted to be a poet. I still want to be a poet. And I had this old poetry book called The Ring of Words. And on the cover, it said, "Bright is the ring of words when the right man rings them." And when you opened it, there was this kind of like a line drawing of a sort of shining land, sort of like the Celtic otherworld. And there's this line from Wordsworth saying, "The earth and every common sight to me did seem apparelled in celestial light." And that wasn't the beginning of my sort of spiritual life, but it was the point at which I realised that there was a path that you could follow, a path to beauty and truth. Because I realised then that every small beauty points to a greater beauty, a beauty which is unfathomable. And these days I'd call that beauty the perfection of wisdom and compassion. So I go on these solitary retreats when I can, to Durdledore. It's this beautiful place. And something happens to me when I've been there for a few days. I feel like all the thoughts just seem to fall away, till all that's left is the kind of sort of breathing of the turquoise sea and the cries of birds and the colours of sunset. And it's just this beautiful place. You know, I remember swimming there naked last year in the sea, and the sea was blue and the sky was blue. And it's just like being in a sadhana. But this is a protected place. This is like a World Heritage Site. But most of our wild places aren't protected. And this is what we've seen over the last 50 years or so, this sort of cutting down and concreting over of our world. So Tara goes to the aid of all beings, though in reality she knows there are no beings to save. So her left leg is in meditation pose, and this is her wisdom aspect, which sees that all things are insubstantial and lacking in selfhood. So everything arises in dependence on conditions and ceases when those conditions cease. Or in the words of the Diamond Sutra, as stars, a fault of vision, as a lamp, a mock show, dewdrops or a bubble, a dream, a lightning flash or cloud, so should one view what is conditioned. So should one view what is conditioned. But as they say in films like The Matrix and Inception, when you get shot in a dream, it still hurts. So it seems that reality consists of love and emptiness. So all the sort of peak sort of spiritual experiences that I've had have been characterized by this same lack of self. And once that illusion of a separate self has been removed, all there is love. So Bhante says this of compassion in his poem The Unseen Flower. Compassion is far more than emotion. It is something which springs up in the emptiness, which is when you yourself are not there, so that you do not know anything about it. Nobody, in fact, knows anything about it. If they knew it, it would not be compassion. But they can only smell the scent of the unseen flower that blooms in the heart of the void. So no separate self, everything's interconnected. So we talk a lot about interconnectedness, but compassion depends on wisdom. And if we don't have enough awareness, then we can't be as kind as we'd like to be. So do we know, for example, that half the Earth's oxygen is made by plankton? Do we believe that flying has no effect on CO2 levels, or that CO2 has no effect on the Earth's temperature? So I saw a really interesting video on YouTube the other day. It was a sort of social experiment where they placed this vending machine in a public place. Some of you must have seen it. and it's this vending machine's offering T-shirts for €2. So people would go up to this machine, and they'd put their €2 in, and then this message appears on the screen. And the message says, "Meet Manisha, one of millions making our cheap clothing, for as little as 13 cents an hour, each day for 16 hours. Do you still want to buy this €2 T-shirt?" And then some sort of buttons appear on the screen, and you can either press buy or you can press donate. And of course, everyone presses donate once they know. So I sometimes think that in Triratna, we can get quite cut off from what we like to refer to as the world, in little commas. A lot of us don't read papers or watch the news or follow politics. And I think that there's a bit of a danger that we could lose touch with the way that things are. So I met up with an order member recently who I have huge spiritual respect for. But they were saying that they didn't think humankind was capable of destroying themselves. And this view just isn't rooted in the truth. I met up with another order member the other day who mentioned that the spring at Gukyaloka had dried up. So I don't know if that's going to be the case all year round, but apparently at the moment it has dried up. So the world's changing, and it's human beings that are causing these changes. So back to Bhante. On the visit when I got my Tara Rupa blessed, we talked about the Green Party, because I'm involved with the Green Party in Brighton, and it was just after Caroline Lucas had been made the first Green MP. And so Bhante was asking me what she was like. And then he said, perhaps you could ask Caroline Lucas to come and speak at the Brighton Buddhist Centre. So this did happen. I saw a photo of it the other day, actually, that I hadn't seen before, of me sort of gazing up adoringly at Caroline. And then Bounty and I talked more specifically about climate change. And what we agreed on was that, firstly, climate change will cause a huge amount of suffering. And secondly, that even though all things are impermanent, it's still worth trying to do something about suffering. So that meeting with Bounty did something quite weird to my energy. At the moment that he said, perhaps you could ask Caroline Lucas to come and speak at the Buddhist Centre, I felt like these sort of two strands of energy were sort of going up, like they were sort of going up like this, of weaving up the middle of some sort of central pole. Really weird. And afterwards, when I went and sat downstairs to wait for Apeksha Devi, at first I thought that the settee was shaking. It was like, you know, when you live really close to train tracks. And then I realized that it was my internal organs or something. Like something inside was like sort of moving around. And I haven't been the same since. So from that point on, I knew that I really wanted to be one of the people bringing ideas of sustainability into Tri Ratna. So I was very inspired a few years back when I read that the Quakers in the UK in 2011 had agreed to become a sustainable community. So in 2011, at a gathering of about 1,500 Quakers, they agreed that climate change was an ethical issue and they agreed to take action. So if only that could happen on a convention. So each Quaker meeting has a sustainable living group whose job it is to work on how to green their public space, their public meeting space, and to feed into their wider communities ideas of sustainability. So Mokshini is here. Mokshini came to an interfaith climate change conference that I put together with the Quakers in Brighton. And she pretty much decided on the spot that we were going to make the Brighton Buddhist Centre sustainable. So we did things like we changed our energy supplier to a green energy company. So green energy is energy that's produced through renewables such as solar power and wind power, whereas conventional energy comes from oil, gas and nuclear. It takes 5 minutes over the phone to change to a green energy company. We did stuff like we looked more closely at our recycling, we began composting, we switched to fair trade products, and we have a new energy efficient boiler. To be honest, our boiler was actually on its last legs already. It seemed like every time I went to the centre, this really lovely Mitra called Scott was sort of standing on a chair, his hand up the boiler. So I know not every centre would be able to just afford a new boiler straight away. But every centre could change to green energy. And we did actually fundraise for our new boiler, and there are grants available. So Colchester is also a sustainable Buddhist centre, and I know that Birmingham is well underway, which we're going to hear about tomorrow. And I think there's a couple of others. So it is starting to happen. But it isn't just about sort of getting our acts together kind of behind the scenes. I believe that truthful speech includes speaking out against social injustice and ecocide. Truthful speech means challenging the wrong views that lead to suffering. And I think that we could be as upfront about ethics and climate change as we are about ethics and vegetarianism, for example. I think that maybe there's a bit of a wrong view about our sphere of influence, that it isn't very large, both positively and negatively. So Buddhist Action Month begins in a few days' time, and this is a great opportunity for us to sort of up our game ethically, you know. So I'm going to be leading a Green Tara Puja this evening. It'll be pretty much a normal Sevenfold Puja, with a Tara mantra and an Amoghasiddhi mantra and some readings. I've got a really low voice, so if anyone would like to lead either the Tara mantra or the Amoghasiddhi mantra, do ask me. I once led the 108 Long Life Mantras for Bante, and I pitched it at this really low pitch, and I had to sit there for like an hour, like listening to everyone struggle, and it was really awful. You know. So we'll be doing a different transference of merit section in the puja. I've always struggled with that particular part of the puja, just because of the lines, just as the earth and other elements are serviceable in many ways. So it's referring to the element of earth, obviously, but I think by saying the earth and that it is serviceable, I think this communicates a bit of a negative message, and it's something we say every day, or some of us say every day. So I'm going to be speaking on Bante's birthday weekend, which is one of the highlights of my existence so far. I'm going to be speaking about nature's beauty and poetry, and why we need to recognise the interconnectedness of all that lives. And I'm going to be proposing in that talk that we change the words to the transference of merit section in the puja. So I've spoken to a few order members already who've either changed it when they do it, or who'd like it to be changed. So I feel that we could just say, just as the elements, or we could drop the word the and say, just as earth and the other elements. But this evening we're going to be doing a section by Shantideva from the Bodhicharyavatara, because it's really beautiful. So the earth goddess, Dhritta, she's very important in the story of the Buddha's enlightenment. So the Buddha-to-be is seated on the diamond throne, the Vajrasana, and Mara appears and asks, what right do you have to take your seat on the diamond throne? And the Buddha says that he has the right because he's practiced the perfections for countless lifetimes. So he's practiced generosity, ethics, patience, energy, meditation and wisdom for countless lifetimes, which is a bit daunting. And so Mara says, well, who saw you practicing the perfections for countless lifetimes? And the Buddha-to-be touches the earth with his fingertips. He makes the earth-touching mudra, and the earth goddess, Dhritta, appears, and she says, I've seen him. So I remember this came to me during my private ordination. I can't quite remember how it went because I was quite overwhelmed. But my tray says something like, and are you effectively going for refuge? And I just thought, God, I don't know. Am I? You know, and then I just touched the earth. And I said, yes, I am. I've had a few dodgy patches since then, mind you. The earth goddess also appears in the Sutra of Golden Light. She promises to come whenever the sutra is expounded, and she says that she'll feed upon the nectar juice of the Dharma and increase the beauty and luster of the earth, and that people will become happy and then they'll practice the Dharma, and so it goes on. So I had this idea that I could find a reading from the Sutra of Golden Light so that the earth goddess would appear here with us now and feed upon the nectar of the Dharma. But when I actually looked at it again, it's so sort of weird and unintelligible. And then I looked up the word expounded and realised it meant to explain. So I gave up on that idea. But I thought I'd read just a few lines on emptiness, because who knows, Dhritta may still come. Cut through the view of self, tear down the net of mental afflictions with the sword of genuine wisdom, and see the abode of the aggregates as empty. Realize the great ocean of enlightenment qualities. So Dhritta, if you're here, know that you're loved and that we really want to serve you. Anyway, so whilst I'm not going to be expounding the Sutra of Golden Light anytime soon, I did have a very interesting experience here at Taraloka of the goddess of emptiness, Pranya Paramita. So this was on my first GFR retreat. And me and Vishvadarkani had gone to the peat bogs, and we were doing 108 Pranya Paramita mantras. And then suddenly, at the exact same moment, it was a shared experience, at the exact same moment, both of us experienced the world of form sort of completely disappear into atoms. And we both panicked and legged it back to the retreat centre. So form is emptiness, emptiness, form. Tara goes to the aid of all beings, although she sees in reality there are no beings to save. And Bhante has said some really interesting stuff about the earth in his talk, Nature, Man and Enlightenment. So he says, we are being warned that certain natural resources are finite and that we're using them all up at an alarming rate. More often than not only using them up at an alarming rate, but using them in a most wasteful fashion. So Buddhists, those who are trying to follow the Dharma, should be very aware of this and should try to use everything of natural origin very carefully indeed. Not only that, but use as little of it as is possible and use it in the best possible way. That is to say, for the benefit, the true benefit, of self and others. The same principle applies to our use of the natural environment. We shouldn't destroy it or spoil it in any way, as for instance through pollution. And above all, we should think carefully before bringing about irreversible changes. Now all this has become the commonplace of informed and responsible thinking. There's no need for me to elaborate. I'm only concerned to underline the general principle involved. That is to say, that the right use of nature is part of the spiritual life. So I'd just like to draw out a couple of points from that. Firstly, just to repeat that last line, the right use of nature is a part of the spiritual life. And secondly, the part where Bhante says, we shouldn't destroy it or spoil it in any way, as for instance through pollution. And above all, we should think carefully before bringing about irreversible changes. So we hear a lot about this idea of trying to keep the temperature, the Earth's temperature, below a 2-degree rise. But it isn't really going to be possible to keep the temperature below 2 degrees. It takes 30 odd years for the CO2 that's already been released to show up as a temperature change. Even the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, who are actually a very conservative body, they're saying that the only way to stay below a 2-degree rise would be to reduce global emissions by 2/5 by 2050. And this is the important bit, and to find ways of reducing the amount of CO2 already in the atmosphere through geoengineering. So basically they're saying that the only way to not get to a 2-degree rise would be to use technology that we haven't actually developed yet. So just to say that a 2-degree rise is going to bring about the complete collapse of the Great Barrier Reef ecosystem. It's going to see a number of island nations submerged by rising sea levels and increased drought and dreadful heat waves around the world. So the IPCC doesn't think that we're on track to avoid this 2-degree rise in warming. But it does think that we may be able to prevent a 3-degree rise this century. However, the IPCC's business as usual scenario, in which we continue to burn significant amounts of fossil fuels, and in which greenhouse gases continue to increase at their present rate, suggests a temperature rise of 3.7 to 4.8 by the end of the century. So a 3-degree rise will bring about the complete collapse of the Amazon ecosystem and the very real threat of conflict over water supplies around the world. And this would also make runaway climate change, where the warming becomes self-sustaining, would almost guarantee that. So this is what we're up against, and what can we do about it? So the real truth is that possibly nothing. It may not be possible in the time that we have left to prevent runaway climate change. The IPCC does not take into account methane hydrate when it produces these figures. So methane is a far more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2, and these sort of unimaginable quantities of it are locked up in the permafrost and under the sea, and that's already starting to be released. But the thing is that we don't know if it's too late. What if it isn't? What if sufficient numbers of people start to grasp this situation? What if they all switch to green energy? What if they all vote green in 5 years' time? What if the world decides to put all of its technology to the service of finding ways to capture and store carbon? So these are big what ifs, I know, and I don't know if the world can change. But we can change the way that we do things in Tree Ratna. We could be doing what the Quakers are doing. When we think about conditionality, we could remember that life on Earth only exists because of very specific conditions, and that these conditions are being caused to break down by human activity. So, in Buddhism, World Peace and Nuclear War, Bounty says that if the government remains unresponsive and the situation is one of extreme urgency, where every day is precious, then more serious measures should be taken, and pressure brought to bear on the government by means of mass civil disobedience along Gandhian lines. So, if the situation is one of extreme urgency, where every day is precious. Well, Bounty was talking about nuclear war, and we're talking about climate change. But climate change represents the same threat to life on Earth as nuclear war, with the only difference being that it's already happening. So I emailed Bounty last year. I wasn't really sure why I was writing to him. I just sort of started typing and said, I don't know why I'm writing to you. And then it just sort of came to me, oh, Bounty, I think I need you to give me a blessing to try to make the climate change work more effective. And I got this really lovely email back from Asvidyut saying, you know, Bounty gives you his blessing, and Bounty really sympathises with it because he totally gets climate change. And he also suggested that I might read aloud his poem, An Apology, every day. So that's become part of my practice. And I'm going to read that for you in a moment. So we're going to split into groups shortly. And in our groups, I'd like it if we could discuss two things. Firstly, this question. If climate change equals suffering, do we in Tree Ratna have a duty to try to prevent it as the Quakers are doing? So I'll just say it again. If climate change equals suffering, do we in Tree Ratna have a duty to try to prevent it as the Quakers are doing? And the other thing I'd really like you to discuss is whether you would want to make your own Buddhist centres sustainable. And other than that, just anything that organically arises in your group. So, Tara goes to the aid of all beings, though she sees that in reality there are no beings to save. When you get shot in a dream, it still hurts. So I was given my sadhana, the green Tara sadhana, at Rivendell in the woods. Farabhadri made this beautiful shrine, and Maitreya gave me the sadhana, and I was just sort of lost in time and space and the sort of voices of the birds. It's quite funny because in the sadhana there's this line about one becomes like a green silk tent shining in the sunlight, and that always gets me because I was part of Butterfield for many years and I had a green tent, but it did not shine in the sunlight. It was completely knackered and the sides were sort of caved in, and when it rained your bed got wet. So there's always dukkha, and everything is impermanent, and it's still worth trying to do something about suffering. The earth and every common sight to me did seem apparelled in celestial light. So I'd like to die believing that this beautiful world was still going to be here. So I'm going to read Bounty's poem for you in a moment, but I'd just like to end by saying that there's a reason why films and books like The Lord of the Rings are so popular, and it's because they contain a truth. And that truth is that good can triumph over darkness, even when the odds seem impossible, if we work together. An apology. We live in the age of apologies. Here is an apology that is much more meaningful than many being made today. Mankind owes a profound apology to the birds for having polluted the air through which they fly, to the ape and the tiger for having destroyed the forests in which they live, to the deer and the bison for ruthlessly hunting them almost to extinction, to the rivers and streams for poisoning them with chemicals, to the earth itself for greedily pillaging its riches of silver and gold, to the ocean for slaughtering the greatest of her children, the whale, for scientific purposes, to the mountain peaks for defiling their virgin snows with our trash, to the moon for rudely invading her sacred space, to the stars for obscuring their brightness with the smoke of our cities, to the sun for not gratefully acknowledging our dependence on his bounty, to the truly great men and women of the past for not honouring their memory as we should, and for not walking in their footsteps. Thank you.